Today, I'm speaking with author and veteran journalist Peter Eichstedt. Eichstedt is a former country director in Afghanistan, former Africa editor for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. He's lived and worked in the Balkans, Eastern Europe, Afghanistan, Eastern Africa, as well as The Hague, Netherlands, where he covered African war crimes trials. And for many people who may know him, he also worked here in Santa Fe for 15 years for the Santa Fe New Mexican. Eichstedt has authored many books, but the most recent is The Dangerous Divide, Peril and Promise in the U.S.-New Mexico Border. He will be reading that work this Friday, May 9th, at Collected Works at 6 p.m. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Peter.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Well, it's a fairly extraordinary bio that we have there, and your books, if people don't know, you've written about child soldiers in Uganda, Somalia's pirates, warring conflict minerals in the Congo, Afghans speaking about their country. And I mentioned to you earlier, one of the earliest books when I first came back to New Mexico, If You Poison Us, Uranium and Native Americans. This is, they call it, a groundbreaking expose of devastation caused by uranium mining on the Navajo Reservation. It was immensely impactful for me. I read it in 1996 coming back here, and it really helped me cover Native American issues here
All
in
right.
the state.
Well, I'm glad it helped. I'm glad it sparked some anger in somebody.
Well, it definitely did. So this bio that I read, can you tell us a little bit about your trajectory and what took you away from New Mexico and to the work you did?
Well, I always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to live and work overseas. And after 15 years in Santa Fe, and I really got some itchy feet, I guess is the way.
That does happen.
One thing led to another, and I ended up getting a Fulbright scholarship to go teach journalism overseas. And I landed in Slovenia, and right about the time that we were bombing Belgrade, was when the Serbs were attacking the Kosovo, and it was just an opportunity for me to start freelancing internationally, and I did, and I got my feet wet in international journalism, and I really never turned back.
It's not an easy field to enter, isn't it? We were talking a little bit about freelancing and jumping in, and it's really pretty a rough competitive world out there, isn't it?
It was really rugged. It was dog-eat-dog in terms of the freelancers, because you were competing with international journalists who were also freelancing from all around the world, and you're competing with the big guys like the AFP, Associated Press, and then, of course, the networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS, who have fleets of drivers, cadres of translators, unlimited budgets. When they would go into a hotel, they would rent an entire floor of a hotel and put up all their correspondence there. And you're trying to compete against these guys. And, of course, editors back home and elsewhere always want something local, something special, something different that they can't get off of the wires. And so they put you in a really, really tough position where you got to go further, faster than anybody else. And freelancers oftentimes the ones that get kidnapped because they're, you know, on the front lines, and they're sticking their noses in places where no one's been before just to get a scoop.
Kidnapped and unfortunately killed in a lot of cases.
Yes.
So, yeah. But why did you choose the countries you chose? I mean, this is really some of the most volatile areas. I mean, child soldiers, the Congo, and then you spent 2 years in Afghanistan.
Well, I went to these places because that's where the real stories are. I think if you go, I mean, there's no real juice, as to say, in some of these hanging out in Paris or Venice or someplace like that. And there's what I was always interested in me, and that's what got me interested in the pushed me to do the book on Navajo uranium miners, was that here's an incredible tragedy, human tragedy, that was taking place right in our own backyard, that was being completely ignored, not only by the government but by the general media, and I was fortunate enough to get hooked up by this man, Michael O'Shaughnessy, who owned Red Crane Press. And he was a publisher, of course, but he was personally interested in this issue. And I had the good fortune to meet him, and we, and that's what launched us on this book, which I thought was just really, I've great stories to tell about traveling around the Navajo Reservation and coming up, with the interviews that I was able to find. But it kind of set me on this trajectory of writing about these incredible human tragedies that are occurring around the world, which the U.S. is ironically involved in one way or another, that nobody writes about. And that's what drives me.
And when you wrote about, for example, If You Poison Us, Uranium and Native Americans, this really was one of the first times that this issue was being discussed on a large scale, wasn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. My book was the first book to really look into this issue and expose it for what the tragedy that it was, and actually continues today. The government has done little or nothing to really remedy the situation. Every few years you have a new team in the Department of Energy that comes in and says, yes, we're going to fix things, we're going to clean things up. They never do.
Well, that was going to be my question. What has been the impact from writing this book, and have there been changes at least in the consciousness of what's happening?
Well, there's been other books written about this as well, but it's one of these issues where it has yet to fire up enough of the right people to really do something. There's as I've found in many places, there's a collective unconsciousness about some of these tragedies and what can and cannot be done with them. Unfortunately, you look at the bestseller list, and it's all about these happy stories. People want self-discovery. They don't want to confront the realities that that exist around the world. And here, this Navajo story is one of the tragic realities. It's right in our own backyard, and people just don't want to look at it.
And they also feel helpless. And I think what you point out, and you certainly point out in the newest book, Dangerous Divide, was the U.S. complicity. How we seem to separate ourselves from the events of all of this. I mean, in Africa, it must be the same thing.
Well, that's what, it was interesting, and I write about that in the introduction, is that I spent my second year in Afghanistan, and I'd always, I've loved Mexico, and I've always traveled a lot in Mexico, and I kept watching the news as the death tolls were mounting within the cartel drug wars. And in the city of Juarez alone, in one, I think it was 2010, 3,000 people were killed. And these are astronomical numbers. That's more people killed in one year in Juarez as a result of the drug wars than were killed in all of Afghanistan. I mean, international soldiers. So here was this tragedy unfolding in America's backyard, and the drug cartels certainly exist primarily because they sell drugs to America. We are the world's largest drug market. So we're directly responsible for what's going on there. But again, it's literally you can throw a stone across the Rio Grande and nothing could be closer to the U.S. And yet we pretend like it's just Mexico's problem. It's not.
We definitely like to do that. Fear, and as you wrote in the book, tourists don't even go there anymore. It's just too dangerous. They need to clean up their mess before we can give them our tourist dollars again.
Yeah, it's terrible. I interviewed a great couple who's had this tourist center across the border from Columbus, New Mexico, in a place called Palomas, and they talked about the huge decline in business that happened after 2011. 9/11. And first of all, the U.S. reacted by saying, "Well, now you have to have a passport to go to Mexico and come back," and that took a big dent out of their business. And then over a period of time, the drug wars and the killing escalated to the point now where they're business, went decreased phenomenally, and it's only recently starting to revive.
And you talk a lot about the difference of post 9/11, that really it was this terrorist phobia that created almost a new perception of Mexico, that everything was about terrorism and that security was paramount. Talk about this change that happened since 9/11.
I know. That was one of the things that intrigued me, was that the this being treated, the border security is being justified as protecting America against the terrorist threat, when in fact, I did a lot of research on this. We have no records of terrorists coming across from Mexico. We do have terrorists, track records of known terrorists coming across the border from Canada, but we don't have anything near the security situation with the U.S. Canadian border, which is twice as long. It's approximately 4,000 miles. The U.S.-Mexico border is approximately 2,000 miles. All of the concentration has been against on the Mexico border. And this has created what I call this frontier of fear that's damaged, life on both sides of the border, but especially along the borderlands.
And you talk a lot, the way you write it is really using these narratives, these personal stories of people crossing in, and some of the determination that comes over. And I think you really humanize it while at the same time exposing a little bit of the absurdity of the security buildup here without a lot of results.
Yeah, it's just, it's interesting that the art debate has been focused on, we need to secure our borders. But that's diverting attention away from the real issue that's going on with immigration is, why do so many people come across? And the reason they come across is not to present a terrorist threat to the U.S. Not at all. They come across to work. And the reason they come across to work is because they can find jobs, and they do find jobs. So here we have approximately 11 to 12 million unregistered workers here that are contributing to our economy every day, and yet they're being treated in the public domain as quote-unquote illegal aliens, like they're a problem, when in fact they're the underpinnings of the U.S. economy.
Yeah, you have a lot of figures about how they're actually aiding the U.S. economy.
And a lot of them are, they're getting paychecks, they're paying Social Security, which they will never collect. They're paying all kinds of taxes, and they don't benefit to any large degree from all their contributions. And the whole issue of that's been, it's all been used and couched in the terms that sprung up after 9/11, which was stopping the terrorism threat, when in fact they're not a threat, they're making a contribution.
Tell us about some of the personal stories that you encountered. Again, you have a lot of narratives throughout this book, and some are truly heartbreaking, the experiences that these people go through and the money that they have to pay. Tell us a little bit about
that. Yeah, that's part of the cartels have realized that they can make a lot of money on this, and they've muscled out all the mom-and-pop operations that used to handle getting people across the border. Now you have to pay approximately $3,000 per person to get across. So I tried to come up with a statistical reality as to how many people are coming across, and I came up with an approximate number of about 1 million people a year. So 3,000 times 1 million is how much money is going to the cartels now. And we've created this because we have a situation where we're forcing people to come across illegally instead of giving them a visa or something very simple like that, a time-limited work visa, which is exactly what these people are doing. They're coming across to work. And so why not give them a visa? They can register. And most people who are the Mexicans that I talked to wanted to come across for a limited amount of time, make some money, and go back. But now they can't go back, because they know they'll never be able to come back to the U.S. again. So they stay. And we've just created this crazy situation where it doesn't really need to exist.
And I would say 3,000 seems to be on the low end, because in some of these narratives, at every stop, it's like they have to pay a little bit more. And, it was 3,000 here, but now it's up to 10,000. And so many of them are caught, and they're sent right back over, and they have to do it all over again.
Well, because they're here illegally, then the cartel people and the human traffickers hold this over people's heads, and quite often they're literally sold into jobs. It's kind of like a servitude or a slavery. And then once they get to their destinations, then more money is extorted out of them to let, you know, so that they can stay in their jobs. I interview people that were had jobs in not only Phoenix but in Albuquerque. I was with the Border Patrol when they stopped a group of people coming across and arrested them. Half of them had jobs already waiting for them in Brooklyn, New York. So it's not just here and there. It's like every state in the country is being, has undocumented workers there who are working. Like, as you know, even walking around Santa Fe, you go into any kitchen in any restaurant here, and I swear you're going to find undocumented workers there.
And you talk about sheep herding in Colorado, too. That seems to be that they're fighting for the legitimacy, saying, wait a minute, we tell them exactly what they're up for. It's the isolated job up in the hills, herding sheep, and yet...
Yeah, that was part of... I got early on in my research, I ran across this, and here are these sheep herders are brought up from South America. A lot of them... And because they have work in the Andes, and so they're used to working up in remote locations at very high altitudes. And here's a legitimate source. They all get work visas to come across. They're agricultural workers. And however, a lot of them are taken advantage of. Like, they're just brought up. They're immediately taken to their sheep camps. They're never really allowed to leave over a 3-year period, and then as soon as their visa's over, they're taken to the airport and flown back to Central or South America. And some of these guys that get hurt, one guy in particular that I got to know had been thrown off his horse. He had hurt his shoulder and his leg. The rancher refused to take him to the hospital, so he just eventually left. And so he got a job in Denver working in a restaurant. And of course, he's undocumented now, so he's here illegally. So it was one story after another, and you don't have to go very far to find these stories.
Right. And you talk a lot about narco trafficking, but the arms weapon, I mean, again, this kind of complicity that America has in terms of creating an incredibly violent situation, adding to thousands, if not tens of thousands of deaths every year. Talk about the Fast and Furious program.
Yeah, I got interested in the weapons aspect after talking to some people who had written books about this issue earlier, and they were talking to me, describing to me about how it's not just a one-way deal. It's not drugs just coming into the U.S. and then U.S. dollars flowing back across the border. There's a tremendous number of weapon sales going across. So it's back and forth. And the money that's used to buy the drugs, of course, comes back into the U.S. in gun sales purchases. And Fast and Furious was an aspect of this big industry that's going on. And the Fast and Furious, as you know, was the reason it's a controversy is that the government was watching these weapons go from these Phoenix area gun shops across the border, and the idea was to track them and try to find out who the ultimate buyers were. Of course, none of this ever transpired. None of the ultimate buyers were ever arrested. But there was an interesting story that I got involved in, that in which the mayor and the former mayor, the former police chief, and a number of other people in the community of Columbus, New Mexico, had gotten into this business. And they were buying weapons from a gun shop just north of El Paso. And they were turning around and selling them. And over a period of about a year, they sold about 300 guns, weapons across the border. And they were ultimately arrested. They have all gone through trial. They've been sentenced. And I think about 11 or 12 of them are now in federal prison, serving terms of approximately 4 to 5 years.
This was 2011, right? Just a few years ago.
Yeah, so it wasn't just Fast and Furious. This is going on in all areas up and down the border. So it's an interesting, it's a give and take situation. It's just not, as is portrayed by a lot of right-wing activists as an alien invasion. That's just a very small slice of the pie.
What is the status now with a lot of guns going over? I mean, obviously, it's still happening. The deaths are still fairly astronomical along there. But is there a change? I mean, there seems to be a real spike in the violence there and a chill on tourism. But what is the status now in Mexico?
Well, things have calmed down a little bit, and it's mostly because of the dynamics of the cartels that have been working in northern Mexico. Sinaloa cartel has, as you know, the El Chapo was the former head. He was just recently arrested, but the Mexican government has made some headway in terms of arresting and eliminating some of the cartel heads. But anyway, there's been a significant decrease in violence, certainly in Juarez, and it's because the cartels aren't fighting with each other so much anymore. Certain cartels have been able to exert their dominance. So things are quieting down, I mean, is the short answer.
Well, that's good for Mexico, for sure. Now, when we talk about terrorism, there were mentions in the book, which surprised me, the Hezbollah apparently training people to dig tunnels, jihadis getting a foothold in Latin America. Is this true, or is this kind of fear-mongering?
It's hard to sell, or hard to say, because there's evidence of Hezbollah getting a foothold in an area near Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay, and Brazil, and that area there. But in terms of, you know, the only evidence that people have been able to really point to is that the tunnels that have been dug by the cartels underneath the U.S.-Mexico border are similar to the ones that are built between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. To me, that's a pretty weak connection. But there is a concern that, and it's a legitimate concern, that Mexico, the Mexican border, could be a gateway for terrorists. But like I said, so far, it's not. It hasn't been.
It's really through Canada. I've been speaking with Peter Eichstead. His most recent book is The Dangerous Divide, Peril and Promise on the U.S.-Mexico Border. He'll be reading from his work this Friday, May 9th, at Collected Works at 6 p.m. So speaking of the security here, you have a statistic. In 2000, 1.6 million migrants were apprehended. 10 years later, after doubling the size of Border Patrol to 20,000 agents, the number of apprehended migrants was down 80% to 327,000 in 2011. Is this just a factor of economic downturn? What is this about? I mean, one, the increase in agents and the lower number of apprehended. Does it mean fewer people are crossing over?
Well, that's a big debate, and there's a real lack of concrete evidence. But most people that are involved in the issue, other than the Border Patrol itself, everybody who's outside of the issue and other than the Border Patrol says that it's an economic issue. Mm-hmm. Because if there's fewer jobs available, then fewer people are going to come across. And, you know, the workers that come from Mexico are well aware of their chances. Otherwise, they wouldn't go through all the physical and economic hardship that you have to go through to get across the border. You know, border security advocates turn around and say, well, no, it's all because we've doubled the size of the Border Patrol. Actually, it's from 20,000 to 40,000 now.
No, oh my gosh.
And, but I, again, there's one study that was done by an Ivy League school that it's an ongoing study where they go down into the villages and communities in Mexico that are the primary contributors of workers and ask them how many people get across, what are your chances? And they came up with these statistics that show that, in fact, an increase in the number of Border Patrol agents does not translate into a decreased number of people coming across. In fact, the chances of you getting across successfully have actually increased with the increase in the Border Patrol. It's just that fewer people are trying to come across, but your chances are still better.
Better, really.
Yeah. And your chances in like 2008, 2009 were, the statistics were that you had about a 50-50 chance. And now, despite the increase in the Border Patrol, you have about a 3 out of 4 chance of getting across.
Now, it seems from the book that the tactics of the Border Patrol, we recently had an interview about Homeland Security here, that all of these tactics are changing. It's becoming much more militarized. And has the cruelty level toward people changed? I mean, it sounds like we're allowing a kind of inhumane treatment that I don't remember hearing about before.
Well, there's a number of humanitarian groups working, and one called No More Deaths in particular, that's really active in the Tucson, Arizona area and along the border. And they conduct interviews with thousands of people who have been detained or after they've been detained, because you can go across the border and there's a lot of reception areas in the communities on the Mexican side where you can talk to people about what happened, you know, what their experiences were. And based on literally thousands of interviews, they've come up with a pretty grim picture that, by and large, of course, the Border Patrol treats people well, but there's a significant number of brutality cases. Women, pregnant women being dumped across the border in these border towns in the middle of the night with nothing. No money, you know, and no protection. Maybe they might have a child with them. There's been lots of cases where families have been separated. The children have been released in one town across the border. The mothers on the other. It's just, a minority of the situations. But as more and more people are deported, you're going to have an increased number of people, you know, abusive situations. That's just part of the animal.
Now, this book, I would think, was completely finished before Obama got the title Deporter-in-Chief. So, talk about the administration's policies at this point.
Well, Obama's been under a lot of pressure to do something, and the Republican Party has kind of held his feet to the fire, saying, we're not going to approve any kind of increases, we're not going to approve any immigration reform unless we increase security. So Obama is trying to do that in the most humane way possible. And even though there's been a lot of misinformation, the more and more the stories are coming out that in fact Obama has kept with his word and said, if you violate the law, if you're here illegally and you've been convicted of a crime, then you're going to be deported. And by and large, the numbers that have been coming out now, with a more careful review, show that, yes, in fact, those who have committed crimes are the ones that are being deported. As long as the people are here and working and not getting into trouble, then that portion of the, you know, migrant worker population has been largely left alone.
So these stories of families being separated and kids pulled out of school, somebody who's been here 40 years, you know, dumped in some town right across the border, this is all about crimes committed.
Well, a lot of the people, I mean, it's not a universal picture, you know, but the concentration has been on, the government has been going after those people who have committed crimes, and they've been the majority of the people who have been deported.
Crimes, let's talk about crimes here, because are they...
Well, certainly felons,
yeah.
But another aspect of this is that if you've come across and get caught a second time, you're charged with a felony. The first time you come across, you're charged with a misdemeanor. And there's a court, it's called Operation Streamline, which gives you an idea of how judicial it is, where literally hundreds and hundreds of people who have been apprehended coming across the border are run through the federal judicial system. You can go to a courtroom in Tucson any day of the week and watch this happen. And there's literally groups, you know, dozens of people at a time stand up in front of the judge. And those who have been caught the second time coming across are charged with a felony, and the judge, at least the days that I was there, he would give them the option of pleading to a misdemeanor and agreeing to a certain amount of jail time, which would range anywhere from 3 to 6 months. And then they would be deported. But if it's the first time, you're only held for about 3 days and then you're deported.
And tell me about some of these kind of holding camps right over the border, I think.
Well, they're they're like way houses. There are people that have been deported. Like the one I went to in right in Nogales, it was right across the border from Nogales, Arizona. There was a place called El Comedor, which is a soup kitchen. And if you came across, the Catholic Church had set up this kitchen, and it was all volunteers. And if you had a piece of paper, you could get a meal meal twice a day for 10 days. And the Mexican government would also give you a bus fare to get back to the town that you had come from. And if you were in, like, women and children who were in desperate circumstances, the Catholic Church had rented apartments in Nogales, where, like, safe houses where they could stay for a while. And but for the most part, people were on their own when you came across. At least you could get some meals. You could get, they had a temporary clinic there where you could get some emergency medical treatment. And I talked to, like, one guy in particular. He had come from California. He was a successful landscaper, lived in California, Southern California, for 18 years, had been caught with a broken taillight. He had been drinking, so he was charged with DUI, and then he was deported. And when I was interviewing him in Mexico, he was getting calls from clients that wanted him to come, that wanted them to do work for him. So, and he was desperate to get across. And he had tried to cross once and was physically out of shape. His feet were badly damaged. And so I was interviewing him, and he had the heel up first, and he was going to try to get back again.
And do you know what happened to him?
Did
you?
No, I don't.
I mean, I imagine you want to follow the trajectory of some of these people. Just how did they make it back? And almost every anecdote that I read, and there was somebody saying, "I want to go back," and yet there were also people saying, "I can't do it anymore." You know,
we
want to go home. This is too much. It's too rough.
Well, I encountered this one man that was heartbreaking. He was from Guatemala. He had come all the way from Guatemala and had crossed the border, and he had been gotten separated from his group. And he had been wandering alone in the desert for 3 days, and he was delirious when we found him, and we gave him some fresh water, and he had just given up, and he told me he wanted to go to New York. That was his dream. And I said, "Well, what do you do? What do you want to do?" And he says, "Well, I'm handy with a shovel." And I looked at him, and he had no clue as to what was really facing him, and it's probably best that he went back.
And he did end up going back.
And the
spreading up of groups, the splitting up, you said it was done with helicopter. They call it helicoptering?
Well, they call it dusting.
Dusting.
Well, the helicopters would swoop right over top of somebody, and of course, I mean, they're big Black Hawk helicopters. They're huge, and they're scary. And they would do several passes over top of a group, and the group would scatter. And this is kind of a dangerous situation because you have sometimes, you know, young mothers with children, you have, and they get separated from their coyotes or their leaders taking them across, and they can end up, you know, dying in the desert because they get lost, they have no supplies, and they don't know where they're going.
And so many do. I mean, there are people who are just found in the desert, bodies every single year, and especially with the heat right now, right? And they drink, you gave an anecdote of people giving fresh water, and what the man actually had was a little bottle of brackish water he'd probably taken from some cattle drinking water.
Yeah, oh, these ponds, cattle ponds.
Yeah. Well, so you try to end the book a little bit on an up note, giving some suggestions on how we can change this. You certainly mentioned a sweeping guest worker program. What are some of the other things that we can do now to change the way, one, we look at immigration in America?
Well, I think that the whole thing is getting away from this, terrorism mentality, because we have to recognize that the people that are the migrants that are coming across the border are coming here to work, and they do work, they do find. So let's recognize and acknowledge the contribution that these people are making in our communities. Why do we have to turn them into second-class citizens and force them to live in hiding? Because we're only exposing them to extortion and other kinds of abuse. So let's let them here, let them come, acknowledge their work, give them a work visa. To me, that would make a, and it would also take all this money out of the hands of the cartels.
Right.
And it's a very, very simple solution. You know, just let's stop looking at these people as terrorists. They're making a contribution to this country. They're literally helping keep the, prices down. Because, you know, they're the guys that do the hot tar roofs here in Santa Fe. They're also the guys, like in my neighborhood in Denver. They're the ones that are up there nailing, you know, shingles on every time there's a hailstorm comes through and demolishes all everybody's roofs. I mean, they're working from, 7 in the morning until 7 at night.
So do you see us near that?
I think we're going to eventually get there. But right now with the Republican-controlled House and... I just don't see anything happening soon.
Well, you can hear more about this Friday, May 9th, at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 p.m. I have been speaking with Peter Eichstedt about many of his books, but the most recent is The Dangerous Divide, Peril and Promise on the U.S.-Mexico Border. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll be speaking with Sanjit Sethi, the Executive Director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. But Peter, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Glad to be here.